talk.
Thank you very much, Eckhart. Well, the first thing, I would like to thank everybody for being here, and Eckhart and Jim and Alexander for inviting me to this seminar. The second thing is that intellectual impairment, today my talk cannot be long enough because my wife decided to abandon me since a small walk last night, so I will have a limited amount of time for talking. So eventually the red light will alert, everybody and my voice will be unhearable. Anyway, so I will speak about dispersion and clustering of particles in turbulent flows, channel open surface and stratified flows. I will start with a very simple phenomenon. And in the previous talks of this week, we ignored inertia in the previous talks by Bala and by Eckhart also, because the models were including all the effects, but inertia was not really important. In our case, we focus just initially on the inertia, and we focus on this problem. So one simple vortex, that's this, a very simple thing, and one particle which is heavier than the fluid. Since the particle is heavier than the fluid, then the particle will not follow the streamlines, and will just go outside. This is rather simple. Now, Greek had a name for this, and it's a long history. I mean, this is Homer, and 3,000 years ago, he already gave a name to this phenomenon, and the motion of the particle according to the streamline, it was the motion kataphusin, which means that according to nature. But also, so this is not very interesting because it's according to nature, so everything is smooth. The interesting thing is the motion paraphusin, which is the motion against nature. So the motion against nature is the centrifugal motion of a heavy particle. Now, if you have this motion, then interesting things will appear. And my talk will be focused exactly on this particular phenomenon which happens in part, with particles in turbulent flows. So remember this picture. Now, another thing. We've already seen this. In the talk of Bala, Bala was using this time scale for the particle. This is just a ratio of the particle inertia to the viscosity of the fluid. But he used a Reynolds-dependent drug. So this thing was changing, I think, in time. In our case, this is fixed. So it's just a reference scale of particle inertia. This is a usual time scale for the particle, which is divided by the flow time scale, and it gives rise to the Stokes number, which unfortunately has the same letters as the Struve number, but it's not the case. This is a particle which with a very small, with a very small Stokes number, particle with intermediate Stokes number, and particle with large Stokes number. This is not interesting, it's like a bullet. This is not interesting, it's like a tracer. This is the interesting particle, and you will see that it takes some time to adjust to the flow streamlines. So this time is crucial, because the particle will see all the forcing, and then will apply all changes to its dynamics a little later than the fluid. So this will provoke a number of chain reactions in the phenomenon. Now, a very simple experiment. If you go to the chemical engineering books, or all the books, and you just want to compute the falling velocity of heavy particles in steel fluid, and you can compute it somehow out this way, and the phenomenon is not very interesting. It's just like a simple fall. Also, if you compute the same thing for light bubbles, so a bubble which is rising in the fluid, you will have this thing. This is not very interesting, but it's not at all what's happening in turbulent flows. What happens in turbulent flows is much more similar to this. This is not turbulent flows, but it's a simple thing to start examining the problem. Now, this is a problem which was investigated by Maxi almost 30 years ago, and in a very nice paper in these fluids. What he did was just to add some steady vertical flows. These are steady, but they spin, same size. It's a two-dimensional problem. And what happens is that if you put heavy particles in the same in the same way as before, so particles are falling, but you add these vortices, you will see that a totally strange thing happens. So you will see that particles actually go down, they don't occupy homogeneously the space, they cannot re-enter the center of the vortex, and they will try to go on this side of the vortex. The interesting thing is that these particles do not go on the rising part of the vortex, but will mostly go on the downing part of the vortex. So what happens is that the fall velocity of particles is larger in a vortical flow than in still fluid, because they have, they add to their settling velocity also the downward velocity of the vortex. Now what happens if you have light bubbles? If you have light bubbles, a strange thing happens. A light bubble has no inertia. In fact, the fluid has a larger inertia than the particle, so the fluid tend to be displaced and go outside, and the particles tend to go inside. So what happens is that the bubbles go at the center of the vortices, and they are trapped there. There's no way they can escape. Now, this thing has been published almost 20 years ago, and this was the intuition of all the community. The community said, heavy particles go faster down, light particles go slower down, because in the average, they cannot escape. So if you compute the average velocity, they go slower. Now, there was a nice paper by Ruiz, Machias, and Perez. This was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in 2004. Now, this paper was sent initially to Nature and was turned down because people wouldn't believe in the results. Now, what was the motivation of the paper? This is the problem. We have a phytoplankton in the ocean. Now, the phytoplankton is just a plant, and phytoplankton are small vesicles, small particles. The phytoplankton is doing a very interesting thing. It goes up, it absorbs the carbon dioxide, and comes down, put the carbon dioxide at the bottom of the ocean, transform it into oxygen, and again it goes up and releases the oxygen at the atmosphere. Now the phytoplankton is estimated to be responsible for 20% of the entire ocean atmosphere CO2 oxygen exchange. So it's a very important chain link in the CO2 thing. What is the effect of which greenhouse effect? So it's it's a very important thing, chain link in this greenhouse effect. Now the phytoplankton goes slowly, and you can wonder how a stupid and dumb plant can do this thing. Well, apparently it can squeeze out some water and absorb some water. So it can change relatively slightly, but enough. It's a specific gravity, so it can be slightly buoyant or slightly heavy. Now what happens that I'm sorry. I must have canceled the plot I wanted to show you. Just a second. It's in another presentation.
Are the phytoplankton also very hairy? Does that play a role?
There are a number of different phytoplankton things, and there might be hairy, there might be self-propelled. In this case, they're not. Really sorry. And then just. Just need a picture. Just need the results of the paper. So the results of the paper by Ruiz et al. Are the following. So this is the intensity of turbulence. And this is the velocity of the phytoplankton, the vertical velocity. You see that units are in meters per day. So they can rise 200, 300, 400 meters per day. What you see is that when they're slightly heavier than the water, they increase their settling velocity with the intensity of turbulence. This is somehow known. This was expected. They made an experiment in a stirred tank. The turbulence was more or less homogeneous. So they said, OK, this is fine. Phytoplankton increases the settling velocity for increasing turbulence level. But the interesting thing is also the following. If you have a slightly lighter than the fluid, the phytoplankton, then it also increases the settling velocity towards the surface of the water. And this was a counterintuitive, was not expected. So why does that happen? Anybody who has the answer? Now, just no answer?
Well, what you showed it earlier were cellular flows.
Exactly.
And turbulence is very different.
Well, in fact, that's different. But the thing, you can explain that also with cellular flow. So the thing is that we have a mechanism by which heavier particles are propelled outside the vortex and they try to go on the downward slope of the vortex. And on the other side, we have a mechanism by which light particles are propelled inside the vortex and cannot escape. So we need a mechanism by which the light particles can go on the uprising part of the vortex, so be propelled outside and have a settling velocity towards the top. And this can happen only if they have inertia. Now, the paper by Maxi was focused on bubbles, but if you have particles which is light but not so light, then you have to add to the particle inertia also the added mass. And if you add the added mass, because the flow, the particle trajectory is non-steady, so you need the non-steady forces. If you add the added mass, then you have the segregation mechanism which brings the particle outside and the settling velocity which brings the particle up. Now, the thing is that we demonstrated this in cellular flow, as you said, which is a toy problem, but if you go at very high ratio of the particle density and the fluid density, so 0.98, 0.99, you can, with this toy model, demonstrate that there are, you know, a range of parameters by which the light particles can be propelled outside the vortex and can go up, and can still go up. Now, this was very interesting. The problem is that we didn't find any similar results in direct numerical simulation of turbulence, so we need some experiments to check again the results of Ruiz et al. But that can be an explanation. Now, just skip this. One motivation in my talk was exactly the plankton problem. The other motivation is the particle deposition and sedimentation, which is probably the issue in this program. So we are focused also on particles much heavier than the fluid, which go to the wall. Now, when they go towards the wall, they interact with the vortices of turbulence. So I will speak initially about this problem, and then following, I will also speak about this problem. So the problem of particle of phytoplankton clustering on free surface flows. Now, if we have heavy particles, so there is another issue which we should remember, and which is very important. It was somehow hinted in the past days, is that particles can have crossing trajectory and can cluster together. Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon. And if you see this the bottom of a swimming pool, I mean, this is something which doesn't surprise us very much. Why does this happen? It happens because this is the bottom of the swimming pool. There is some focusing of the sun rays on the bottom of the swimming pool. And this focus on the sun rays makes some regions very lighter compared to the others. And this phenomenon is called caustics. Now, if you do a numerical simulation, and if you do direct numerical simulation of homogeneous turbulent flow, and you put so many particles, and if you, it's like when you do the shower. I mean, you have so many particles inside, and you see like an homogeneous distribution. But if you cut that distribution with a cross plane, then what happens is that you will see that particles, so this is particle number concentration, this is really number concentration. There were probably 20 million particles in this simulation. And in this case, you can see that you have clustering of particles inside tiny regions with a structure, which is very similar to the caustics which we've seen in our personal swimming pool. In California, in Santa Barbara, must be very popular to have a swimming pool. I don't have it at home. So anyways, we have the same problem. Now, these things are very interesting. These clustered regions, because all the things happen there. And you see all these particles go there, and if anything, which is due to the proximity of particles, should happen: a reaction, a collision, coalescence, breakage, rupture of particles must happen where there is a high probability that two particles get together. So remember these things, which are very important. Now, this was just a preliminary part of my talk, and now I'll go into the details. So the problem we will focus will be first the effect of clustering and scales on the position. I will use, for all the simulation, for all the talk, the direct numerical simulation of turbulence and the point-wise particle approach. So direct numerical simulation of turbulence is done in very simple archetypal flows. It's going to be channel flow, flat walls, not very applied, I'm afraid, very fundamental, very flat walls. But the results of the turbulence simulation will be, I trust them a lot, so it will be very accurate. And the point-wise particle approach, of course, with a point-wise particle, you cannot consider the size of the particles, but I think it can enlighten some, it can shed light on some of the specific features of particle motions. I will speak later about some modeling issues in LES, so this is going to be what I believe it is the truth for this approach. And what if you want to compute higher Reynolds number? You have to use LES. Potentially also later we can use also RANS. Then we speak about surfacing and clustering of slightly buoyant particles in free surface flows. I will not speak much about thermal stratified flows because I realize that there is not much time for this. Maybe we can discuss later with somebody who's interested. When we break the Overbeck Businesque approximation, so we consider that the fluid changes properties like viscosity and buoyancy. And finally, we speak about surfacing the cluster of slightly buoyant particles in stratified flows, so like this. Now first, this is just the sketch of the problem I'm focusing on. So it's a channel bounded by two flat walls with many particles inside. And Reynolds number will be based on the wall variables. So U here is not the bulk velocity, but it is the shear velocity, so it's proportional to the pressure drop. And the Reynolds number are going to be fairly low. And the equation of motion for the particles, in most of the cases, you don't see it, or you do, only probably people from the upper rows. So there is inertia, there is drag, and just the nonlinear correction of drag. So there is nothing else. This approximation is valid when particles are heavy. If particles are not heavy, then you should add all the other forces, like the added mass, and I mean, we know that. Now, one problem. Initially, I defined the Stokes number of the particle like the ratio between the time scale of the particle and the time scale of the fluid. What is the time scale of the fluid? Well, the time scale of the fluid, if you have vortices all the same size, it's fixed. If you have a homogeneous turbulence, the time scale of the turbulence can be any scale you choose, but any scale you choose will be homogeneously distributed in the flow field. So consider the Kolmogorov time scale, which is usually used in homogeneous turbulence. Then the Kolmogorov time scale will not change if you change the position of the particle in the domain. It will be always the same. But if you have a wall, if you have non-homogeneous turbulence, you will have, for instance, the Kolmogorov time scale changing with the distance from the wall. And it can change by a fair amount. It goes from slightly above 2 to 12. So it can change. And if I was in a larger channel, then it would go up and go up and go up. So what happens is that if I compute the Stokes number, and this is a semi-logarithmic plot, if I compute the Stokes number...
Can I just ask about this? I'm a little bit confused because the Kolmogorov time scale is a decreasing function of the intensity of the turbulence, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. We computed the Kolmogorov time scale with the dissipation, and it goes
this way. I mean, the standard expression is you, isn't it, you take, you multiply the kinematic viscosity by the dissipation per unit mass.
Yes.
And then take 1 over the square root.
I think so.
Yeah, So in that case, the Kolmogorov timescale should be greater where the turbulence intensity is lower. And I'd expect the turbulence intensity to be lower by the wall.
Well, that definitely, but the Kolmogorov timescale, I'm sure, goes smaller towards the wall. And this is understandable also, because close to the wall, you have the structures which are much smaller. All the turbulence is reduced in scale. There is not, from a very rule of thumb viewpoint, a big vortex cannot have room enough close to the wall. So all the vortices have to decrease their size when you approach the wall. So this is why the Kolmogorov time scale also reduces.
The turbulence time scale and not the Kolmogorov time scale?
This is the Kolmogorov.
The time scale which is related to the size of the air is the turbulence time scale. Is not necessarily a Kolmogorov.
Well, this is the definition of the Kolmogorov timescale, which is usually used in homogeneous turbulence, where it is properly defined, applied also to wall turbulence.
So this is based on local dissipation?
Local dissipation. So this is, so what happens is that the local turbulence scales, the vortices decrease going to the wall, and because of this, if you scale the time scale of the particle with the local turbulence scale, any local turbulence scale, what happens is that particles grow bigger when they approach the wall. So the problem is very interesting, because you want, for a simpler approach, you want your particles to be small. Because if particles are small, as Bala showed us 2 days ago, the plot, you can apply many simplified approaches, but if particles are large, so their inertia is larger compared to the vortices, and what happens is that there is no way to escape the problem of modeling the particle inertia close to the wall, because they are going to be larger than in the middle of the channel. So a tiny particle in the middle of the channel, while it approaches the wall, it will grow bigger compared to the scales. Now, so this is one issue.
Yes. Just concerning the Reynolds numbers, you mentioned this paper in the beginning with the phytoplankton.
Yes.
And, didn't they have much larger Reynolds numbers from their experiment? I mean, something like that.
Definitely, yes, yeah. Definitely.
But still, you think that the study you're doing at Reynolds numbers 1 million below that was it? What?
Well,
it's still relevant to that problem, or is it just a loose motivation for?
Well, they didn't explain the mechanism by which their particle would go up. They did explain was applying the previous knowledge, the reason why the heavier particle go down faster. So there is no explanation currently for their lighter particle result. In a very quickly, we did the vertical flow experiment. And that gave us a hint that can be a possible mechanism. I'm not saying that it is the truth, but that actually was enough to convince myself and my student.
Typically, it's so hard to reach any practical Reynolds number. This is the flaw I often use. If you invoke Reynolds number similarity or something like that, provided you are in the fully turbulent regime, the same physics works.
That's clear that if you are on high enough Reynolds numbers, then everything is the same.
Yeah. Also, the different thing is that they did a turbulence in a tank. We are doing a turbulence in a boundary layer, so it's a different problem. So I'm not claiming that I cannot either confirm or disconfirm the results. It's just an interesting result, which, if anybody's interested, needs to be confirmed, if you have an idea. Now, what I will show you now? I will show you what happens in our channel with particles. Now, you see that here we have small particles, tau p plus. Here in the following, we'll define the Stokes number. So the Stokes number of the particle based on the wall scales, not based on the Kolmogorov time scale. So this is based on the wall scales. So this is one, small, 25, intermediate, 100, large. Now I just plot what happens to particles which are in the middle plane of the channel, where the scales are larger. So what I see is the following, and you can see the different behavior of these things. Homogeneously distributed like tracers, rather homogeneously distributed like heavy particles, which are totally irrespectful of the vortices and they cross the vortices. And these particles actually show some segregation behavior. So what I would suppose is that this particle 25 scale with something which is important in the boundary layers. Now if I show you what happens in a cross section, so you have the walls here and the particles are small, intermediate and large here. Now you see a very interesting thing. Remember that in this case particles are just driven by the drag. It's a nonlinear drag, so it accounts for a larger Reynolds number of the particle, but there is no other force. And you will see, I'll show it again, well, it's not necessarily that I show, you see here not very much segregation, more segregation, less segregation. The gray, black, and white areas here are regions where the velocity towards you is white is large, black is low. So here, large velocity towards you, across the plane. Here, slow velocity towards you. And you see a very interesting thing. You see that in the three cases, the velocity structure says the same. The velocity has the same structure. But here, you see that there is no segregation. In particular, there is no segregation near the wall. Here you see an interesting pattern. You see that alternated, there are regions with no particles and regions with high concentration of particles. And here you have more or less the same. Now, this thing also, perhaps you had the impression that some of the particles which are initially homogeneously distributed across the channel is actually going towards the wall. Now, this must be an effect of segregation. So there is more. There are more particles near the wall here and here. No gravity, remember. So gravity has no effect on here. There are more particles in this picture than in this picture. Here we have many particles in the center of the channel, not in the other case. And if I plot the number concentration for, I put also another small type of particles, which is almost like tracers, you see that initially, this is the normalized number concentration of particles. Initially, we have all particles distributed homogeneously in the channel. And then for increasing the time scale of the particles, so for increasing inertia of the particles, we have an increase of number concentration close to the wall. Here, this is one wall units to the wall. One wall units to the wall is well inside the the viscous sublayer. But the interesting thing, I didn't plot it here, I will plot it later, but is that the maximum number concentration is obtained for particles of size 25. Particles, if I plotted particles of size 100, they would have lower concentration at the wall. So now we are at the point in which we see that we have some preferential concentration for a specific size of particles. And another result, we have a larger number concentration of particles near the wall. Perhaps these two phenomena are related. So there is more clustering for particle 25 and more concentration at the wall. We think that these two phenomena are related. In fact, they are. And look what happens here. This is just one snapshot of the movie I've shown you before, and we just focus on this region. If we focus on, this is particles 25. We focus exactly on this region, and we plot what happens around this region. Now, in this plot, which seems rather complicated with many color codes and things, it's in fact rather simple. Blue is low velocity towards you. Red is high velocity towards you. Vectors are just vectors in the plane. Blue particles are particles with wall normal velocity. Here is the wall with wall normal velocity directed upward. And purple particles are particles with wall normal velocity directed downward. So you see that we have like a fountain of particles here. But if you see the structure, you have two big vortices here. These two vortices are just rolling this way, and they're just pushing particles together and draining particles from the wall layer up to the mid part of the channel. On the outer side of the vortex, all these particles are coming down. So the thing is that if you can go down to the archetypal motion of small vortices close to the wall, you can find exactly in this picture what was found by Maxi in previous times. So that basically you have segregation and eventually deposition, which is what we will look for. So you have lots of segregation due to inertia by these vortices. Now, if you look at the sides of this vortice, just a rule of thumb examination, the sides of this vortice, you can see that the size of this vortice is around 30. In fact, it is 25. The most probable size of vortices inside the boundary layer is 25 in wall units. Now, the size of the vortex is 25. This is why the size of the particles which are more probable to be segregated is 25, because their time scale is exactly the time scale of the vortices. So this is why particles with time scale 25 segregate and deposit faster than the others, because they match with the typical size of the vortices here. Now, let's go a little more quantitative here. We wanted to compute the segregation of these particles, and we can use different methods. In this slide, we use the following. This method is just compute the statistics of the distribution. This is a regular distribution, so let's suppose we divide our domain into cells of the same size. And then we count the particles per cell. If we count the same number of particles per each cell, then the distribution would be regular. If it was random, then it would be described by Poisson distribution. I mean, it is a clustered, so we don't know the distribution. It will be whatever it will be. So now we can compute, though, the distance from this distribution to this distribution. So the variance of this distribution will be, in fact, the measure of how clustered particles are. So the difference from this distribution to this distribution will be our measure of clustering. The more particles are segregated, the more is the difference, the larger is the difference between these two distributions. And if we compute this distribution for particles with Stokes number 25, we see that in the center of a chain, these are different times. But at most of the times, we see that in the center of the channel, the difference between the Poisson distribution and the clustered distribution, the real distribution, is not much. But going towards the wall, actually, from Z plus equal to 25 to the wall, you have enormously clustered distribution. So particles equal to 20, with time scale equal to 25, they cannot really stay homogeneous distribution, but there is a strong action of these vortices.
For my understanding, if Stokes 25, does that mean that the size of the particle is also approximately 25 wall units?
The Stokes of the particles, so suppose that the time scale of the fluid is the following. If I have the Stokes of the particle equal to 25, it means that tau p over tau f is 25. Yeah. Now, for the size of the vortices, this is not 25. Those big vortices had sides 25 in these times, in this scale. So we had vortices time scale equal 25. So in the same scale, both the particle and the vortex had the same size.
Right. And that means that if you would express the particle size in wall units, they are
smaller. You mean the diameter of the particle is much smaller than one.
Okay.
In fact, you can see that if we can, I mean, in the previous slide, it's easier to see. The last point is the last point at which we could make the particle reach the wall. So you see that, I mean, here we have one is wall units, and here we have 0.1, here we have 0.2. So this particle is 0.4, because this is the radius. And this particle is 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.8. So the small particle.
Density ratio. So what is the density?
1,000. These are droplets in almost 1,000 droplets in air.
Because that ratio of length scale to time scale will depend on density.
On density, exactly. Now,
In homogeneous turbulence, the particles are distributed on the fractal set.
They are.
And Did you try that type of characterization in this case?
Well, in fact, in this plot, there is the correlation dimension, which is a measure of the it was not necessary at this time, but we will use it later. So this this clustered distribution we computed for all the particles, and we put in this plot the Stokes number of the particles, and here how segregated are they. Now the black dots are the dmax, so the deviation from uniform distribution. And you see that small particles are rather uniformly distributed, no deviation. 25 have the largest segregation. 100 go again towards more uniform distribution because they are, as I said, I mean, they don't care about the vortices. Now, the other measure is the correlation dimension, which I explain later, but you're probably familiar with that. It goes the reverse. So the more clustered is the distribution, the smaller is the number. And they agree together, of course. So what happens? So this was our explanation of what happens. Now, if we compute the deposition flux, the deposition velocity of the particles towards the wall, this is just the mass flux of particles towards the wall, and if we plot it against the Stokes number, we see that the deposition flux in turbulence increases with the Stokes number. This plot is rather well used in the sedimentation fields and in the particle separation fields. These are particles equal to 25. These are particles equal to 100. You see that particles equal to 100, they deposit at the same rate of particles equal to 25. But for a different reason. It's because they are so inertial that they will go to the wall just because of a strong kick they received in the center of the channel. These particles, in fact, deposit because they are first segregated, and then once they're all there, they all together are brought to the wall. So you can see that these particles enhance what is the Reynolds analogy. You of course, you are familiar with the Reynolds analogy for heat and mass transfer. So the Reynolds analogy say that if the unit, the scalar should go to the wall more or less like the momentum goes to the wall. In this case, there is an enhancing of this effect due to the focusing and clustering of the particles, which emphasizes the Reynolds stress, the Reynolds analogy. Now, the mechanism by which particles deposit is therefore the following. There are several mechanisms, but the most interesting mechanism is the mechanism by which we have particles which are first segregated here and then go to the wall. Now, I didn't tell you about the structure of the turbulent boundary layer, but basically, in a turbulent boundary layer, what happens, very simplistic, is that you have vortices. But since you have an extremely strong shear, all these vortices are not just, homogeneously distributed. They are stretched. And so all these vortices are just aligned with the mean flow, and so they roll in this way. These are the most important vortices. I'm sorry for my naive explanation, but this is why these vortices are stretched and aligned with the mean flow. So the thing is that first there is segregation and then there is deposition. And this is why particles which segregate most can deposit more. Now, we think we, and this was a model, of course, because there was only inertia and drag. Now, suppose that we want to apply this model to verify what happens to higher Reynolds number, to discover why the Ruiz et al. Paper had such a high Reynolds number. So we should do the large eddy simulation. Now, what is the problem with large eddy simulation? Now, you have a nice picture of a girl here, which is my daughter, in fact, and my wife will not approve what I'm about to do. But what happens is that we have a nice picture here. And here we see, the structures. Our capability of recognition, of pattern recognition, is based on structures. So it is very important that we see the eye, the nose, the mouth, the ear here, glasses. Now, if I had a lousy camera, I would do this. So I would reduce the pixel. So what happens is that I pick the average value of the pixel, and then I average it over a small square. and I do this under resolved image. What can it can be? A man, a female, I don't know. I of course will never recognize the person, but I can perhaps recognize that there is some human being filtered. Now, if I do words, I mean this can be anything. Now, this is exactly the concept of largette dissimulation. So, you don't have the details, you don't have the patterns, you just have the average patterns. So, at a point, you have a big thing which just gives you the average. And the concept of largette dissimulation is that, provided that I can have the same quantity of energy in this square as in the DNS, so in the same area, then I am sure that the overall shear or pressure drop in the turbulent flow is recovered. That is the basic issue of LDS. So I have to take care that the quantity of energy in this square are the same. But now I have a problem. I want my particle to follow nicely all the details of the vortices. How can I do that? I mean, a particle will cross these vortices and will ignore whatever structure, small structure, is filtered by the presence of the vortex. This is crucial, especially if you are interested in modeling the clustering in acoustics dynamics. So we did an experiment. So what is the error we make when we do an LES? And we do the same thing like with the picture. We got our nice direct numerical simulation, and we filtered it. So we filtered this one time, two times. So we had something which you see the colors are in the same position, blue, yellow, red, but you lost all the details. Will those details be important? Now, a rule of thumb approach will say, well, but you told us that a small particle will follow the vortices, but you have a large particle, then it will not follow the vortices, and it will just follow the big vortices. So perhaps one can say, if I have large particles, I'm safe using LES. If I have small particles, I have to do something. Now, this is just something that people call the perfect LES, because it's a filtered DNS. So the structures are there at the time where they should be. All the dynamics is captured. The only thing is that it is averaged at each time. We don't have models, so this is better than the a posteriori, they say LES. This is called a priori LES. Not sure why they choose a priori and a posteriori. To me, it doesn't make sense. But they call it a priori LES. So what happens is the following. If we compute the particle number concentration at the wall as a function of the wall distance for small particles, these particles and these particles, we will see that for small particles, we have a decrease in the peak of the number concentration. Now, the number concentration is a statistics which is very hard to obtain because it is the time integral of the particle flux to the wall. So, I mean, every time step, you add a small error which eventually grow large. So this is sort of unfair, but it's something we choose to measure to emphasize the error. So if you have small particles, you have a decrease of the peak of the concentration. If we have intermediate particles, there is a decrease also. If we have Stokes number 25 particles, also we have a decrease of the concentration. So what happens is that for all types of particles, we have a decrease in wall concentration when we use LES. And the different lines correspond to different filtering. So is that surprising? Not in my view, because if we filter the structures, then particles have to go to the wall in straight lines. They are not focused in the specific regions to follow the instantaneous Reynolds stresses. So this is not surprising. And the following slide I'm showing you is this. Now, this is the deviation. So I said LES does a bad job because it doesn't predict clustering. This is clustering. This is a region close to the wall, and this is a region in the center of the channel. Now, in the DNS, this is the Stokes number of the particles. In the DNS, we have a little clustering for small particles. some clustering for intermediate particles, maximum clustering for particles equal to 25, small clustering again for 100 particles. If you do the LES, we don't find the same clustering. So we have lowered the position velocity, lowered the position flux, because we didn't have the clustering in the first place. This is what happens in the central part of the channel. And this is interesting. This is another question. We see that the DNS and LES, they predict, LES predicts somehow lower clustering. But for large particles, you see that LES, in fact, is larger, predicts larger clustering for larger particles in the center of the channel. Why that? We think this is actually in agreement with other people, so it's not only our result. But it is, I mean, the possibility is that large particles do not perceive the small filtered fluctuations as large vortices to interact, but more like a diffusion type effect. So big clusters or large particles tend to diffuse away due to the small structures. But this is not going to be a big problem. Now, this is the individual trajectory of one single particle. So in our filtered cases, we had three particles of three different colors starting from the same position. The blue is the DNS. This is filtered one. This is filtered quartz. And we see that particles have a different trajectory in the three fields. So we are doing Lagrangian tracking. So at a point, what has the position of this particle to do with its real position? Nothing. I mean, they are not even related. They are totally different things. So we are simulated to different things. And from this plot, we can understand that when we do LES with particles, we do two types of errors. The first type of error is that if the particle is in a filtered field, then the force acting on the particle will be proportional to the velocity of the fluid, which is different from the velocity originally computed by DNS. So the first error is that forces acting on particles. The second error is that particles will not even be in the right position. So they will be in a different position and will experience a different force. So this is why predictions are different. So now, what we want to do? We want to be smart. I have not been able yet to increase our intelligence, but we will try to compute the errors. And basically, we want to put the white ball over the blue ball. What should we do? At any time step, we should force the white ball to go again on the position of the blue ball. In this case, at least we could recover the position even if we don't recover the forces on the particles. So let's see how this error goes. So this is the concept of what we want to do. At every time step, we want to push the particles back in the original trajectory. So the first thing we did was to compute the error between these two particles, the relative error. And if we compute, because we say, suppose that this error, the error in the position of the particles, the error in the velocity experienced by the particle, suppose that this error has a simple shape, it's a Gaussian, then I can put a white noise and I can put back in the average particles in the correct position and under the correct flow velocity field. But suppose that this error has a strange shape, how can I do that? And in fact, this error has a strange shape, as usual. And this is just the mean values of the subgrid scale velocity error. So it's the difference. This is the difference between the streamwise velocity of particles, actually of the fluid, at the particle position in the DNS and in the LES case. And you see that it's a rather small error here, and then it has this strange shape. I mean, how could you model that? And this is for the whole normal velocity. And if I go to the PDF of this distribution, I see that this distribution are actually non-Gaussian, they have large tails, And not only, they are not even symmetric, because the distribution is more skewed when particles are going to the wall, because at the wall, they have less intensity of turbulence. So this is the point, the standing point where we are now. So we don't know what to do. We never, we were not able to come up with a good model, but we know how to compute the errors if we had a DNS previously. So basically, we don't know anything. Now, this is the... My voice is helping me. So it didn't abandon me for a moment. And now let's see what happens at surfaces. Now, free surface flows are strange flows. These are our simulation. So we do exactly the same simulation, but we took away the lid of the channel, and now the simulation has a free surface. So there is a free slit. The only constraint is that waves cannot be formed. So the wall normal velocity to the surface is bounded to be zero, but the other velocity can have any value they want. And we do this thing. These are the big vortices. It's driven by a pressure gradient, so it's like a channel with a mild slope. And this is the simulations we do. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at the free surface, then the turbulent structure at the free surface is somehow different from the turbulent structure at in the three-dimensional turbulence. Somehow, at the free surface, people say that turbulence is almost a two-dimensional. In fact, it's dimensional at the free surface, but it can behave like a two-dimensional turbulence if it existed, which doesn't exist. But so what happens is that if you compute the spectra of turbulence at the free surface, this is for two Reynolds numbers we simulated, you have different behavior of the spectrum. And the spectrum at the free surface is the balls, and the spectrum is the mid-channel, which can be considered fully developed three-dimensional turbulence is the squares. And you see that the spectrum at the free surface goes down much steeper, and you have for both Reynolds number. So we have a different scaling. What happens, apparently, I'm not sure, but it seems that the small structures at the free surface, they don't count very much. You see, small structures at the free surface don't have enough energy, and the energy of the small structure is transferred to larger structures. So this is, some people speak about a reverse cascade or upscale energy transfer. There are this type of mechanism. Now, what happens at the free surface? Look, the fluid, the big vortices of the bottom wall, they go up the free surface. And on the free surface, if you look, for instance, at the ocean, but also a small river, a small channel, you can see that there are almost singular circular vortices. Now, this is what we've shown. And we have water which is coming up and water which is going down. Now, the water which is coming up is bringing some mass, energy from the bottom part of the channel, and then it has to go down because of the continuity. These are called upwelling, and it's a source-type region. And this is downwelling, and it's a sink-type region. Now, if we put particles, what happens? Particles are slightly buoyant, so density is 0.9. These particles, of course, will go up in the upwellings, and will go down in the downwellings. Here, particles, the inertia is not important in this case. Particles do not sink just because they are buoyant. So what happens is that they are forced to live in a sort of boundary which is in between the upwelling region, the source region, and the sink region. They cannot go down with the fluid, so they are forced from the source region to go into the sink region. And they do all these nice patterns. Now we computed in this plot, so they all do this, they will have this filamentary structure. Now this plot has a superposition of particle position at a certain time and of surface divergence. If we compute the surface divergence, of course, there being surges and sinks, we will find that there are regions where the fluid is compressible, and there are regions where the fluid is expanding. Now, positive divergence means expanding fluid. So the positive divergence is the fluid, is the source. Negative divergence means compressing fluid, so it's the sink. And we see that all particles tend to go into the blue regions. You see all this filamentary structure? They tend to stay in the sink. This is obvious. I mean, it's just very intuitive. I mean, a particle will go into a sink region. I mean, think about your bathtub vortex. You have a floater, it will go there, but it will never sink.
Are these particles with low Stokes number?
Very low, yeah. Very low.
They're
traces, but with buoyancy. Mm-hmm. So you can consider inertia. I mean, we put all the, I mean, we solved the complete equation with inertia and drag, but the inertia doesn't count really much. It's only the buoyancy which pushes. It's like a plankton. I mean, it's only the buoyancy which pushes the plankton. So buoyant traces. And this is what happens at a rather larger Reynolds number. So the same thing happens. Now, if we go, now we want to see, this is the entire domain. This structure seems very big compared to the domain. So how big are these structures? What is the scale? What are the scales of these vortices at the surface? Now we computed for the two Reynolds number, this is small Reynolds number, and this is large Reynolds number. We computed the Kolmogorov scale, time scale, and the Lagrangian time scale. And if we compute the Kolmogorov time scale, we see that it grows from the bottom wall to the free surface, which is what we found before. But if we compute the Lagrangian time scale, we see that it grows much more from the bottom wall to the free surface. Why did we have to compute the Lagrangian time scale? I'll show you in a second. But remember that the Lagrangian time scale, the important thing is that it is much longer, say, in time than the Kolmogorov time scale. And why we computed that? We computed that because we wanted to see how persistent are these clusters of particles. So what happens is that these particles arrive at the turbulence rather homogeneously, the surface rather homogeneously distributed, then they try to go down. Then they're clustered. For how much time they stay there clustered? This is important if you want to predict the distribution of plankton and the free surface. And so in this case, we computed the correlation dimension. Now the correlation dimension basically is computed in the following way. You consider one base particle, and you consider the distance from one base particle to all the neighboring particles. Now, if the average distance scales with a square of the distance, then all these particles are uniformly distributed over the surface. So the exponent of the scaling distance will tell you the correlation dimension. So if the surface covered scales as the distance, then they're uniformly distributed. If the surface covered scales linearly with the distance, then it will be aligned. If the surface covered scales with whatever exponent it likes to scale, then it will be, we don't know, fractal distribution. It will be something we scale to the exponent nu. We computed what happens to this cluster. So now this is the clusters. You see, this is a upwelling, so the flow is coming up. All the particles are more or less homogeneously distributed in this upwelling, which comes up, sort of spinning, so these particles are spinning. Now, after a little while, this thing will stay here, because these big vortices stay attached to the free surface for a long time. And then what happens is that these particles will try to reach a filamentary distribution just neighboring this vortex. And this thing will go for long times. Now here we plotted the evolution of the average correlation dimensions for all these clusters we found. And we tried to scale that with an exponential law. Now, we tried before with the Kolmogorov-Tang scale. It was too small. So we tried again with a suitable Fruit-Tang scale, which is, in fact, we don't know how much it is, but it's proportional, say, to the Lagrangian time scale. And what we see is that the cluster dimension will go from 2 to close to 1 in times which are 2 times the Lagrangian time scale, 4 times, 6 times. It can reach the filamentary distribution after 4 or 6 Lagrangian time scale, which is an extremely long period. So what happens is that there is a structure, upwelling, which forms this filamentary distribution, and this filamentary distribution sits there for times much longer than the structures that they generate. They overleave the structures.
What does it mean it goes below 1?
It goes below 1.
Why?
I don't know. This is, now it goes very slightly below 1, and this is just the uncertainty. This is just the average over all the cluster. So we're not sure exactly what it is. I mean,
well,
this is
one. Below one is not a problem. I mean, the strings can break up, and then you will get Cantor sets, and it can fall as much as to
they
zero.
Can, there are some points. That's what I mean. Yeah. Particles can cluster into points. I mean, this is, of course. I mean, we can, if even I and my students who did the simulation, if we can believe the first part of the plot, we don't believe to the last part of the plot, because of course. There is a volume occupied by a particle. There are things which forbid particles, of course, to overlap on top of each other, as you said. But anyways, we think that even if particles cluster up to this point, they really have a long time, a long lifetime. So this is somewhat interesting because it tells you that this plankton, or buoyant particles, which can be floating, sitting on the surface, can have a distribution which is not optimizing the distribution which can absorb the CO2 at maximum, because if they're all there, it means that this structure are not optimizing the transfer. Now what happens what happens if we stratify the flow? Now in the ocean in channels, the flow is usually stratified. This is the last part, so I'm planning to finish around 12. It's fine?
Yeah.
I'll just skip this. What happens if we add stratification? Flow is the same. It's like a channel or the ocean. The sun is heating. This flow is stratified, so there is this is hot, this is cold. What happens is that mixing is reduced. If mixing is reduced, there is an interesting thing. There might be internal waves which somehow make the mixing from the bottom part and the top part more difficult. We did the following simulation for 3 different Richardson numbers. The Richardson number is based on the thermal expansion coefficient. On the buoyancy anyways, like, I think it's the same that you used yesterday, right? It's the same Richardson number you used, right? More or less. There's temperature here. Yeah.
We wrote it in a different way, yeah.
Yeah, but it's
basically buoyancy.
Yeah, it's a buoyancy.
Divided by velocity square.
So if the Richardson number is zero, there is no stratification. If the Richardson number is higher, there is a stronger and stronger stratification. We did 3 computations for Richardson number equal to zero, equal to 164 and equal to 247. And these 3 bricks are our 3 channels. No stratification, intermediate stratification, large stratification. We see that here it's temperature distribution, because we put temperature also in the Richardson number equal to zero, but in that case, in this case, temperature is a passive scalar, so it doesn't affect the mixing. In this case, you can see that the structure is much more uniform compared to this. And in this case, the structure is even more uniform. And here you can see that there is a different behavior from the top part and the bottom part of the channel. In this case, you have internal waves. You can perceive them. Here you can see them better. And this internal wave forbid a good mixing between the high part and the bottom part. thermal gradients will be rather uniform here and rather steep here. So there's a strong steep thermal gradient in the thin region underneath the surface, and rather uniform thermal gradient lower. And this is just the behavior of the thermal gradients. This is for passive scalar, temperature is passive scalar, and these are the two cases in which temperature, in fact, is an active scalar. And this is just the average velocity. You see that the average velocity is increased. We have a pressure gradient driving the flow. This is known. It's just that the average velocity increases due to stratification because there is a damping of turbulence. Now, if we want to compute the surface dynamics, and here you see that you have surface divergence here on the right, left part of the panel, and surface temperature here. You see that if you have, there is a correlation between surface divergence only when the Richardson is zero. There is not much correlation between surface divergence and temperature when the Richardson number is high. What does that mean? It means that if you have a source, an upwelling of fluid, then it doesn't necessarily carry with it temperature. There is a decorrelation between upwellings of fluids and the mechanism by which temperature is transferred to the surface. So if we have Richardson zero, we have a strong correlation between the mass transfer and the turbulence. In this case, we have less correlation. And this thing is just another plot. And this thing is just another plot. And this thing is just the final plot which we computed. Now, I said before that particles in the Richardson zero case, so the case I shown you before, no stratification case, particles which reach the surface by the upwelling and are not able to go down, to sink in the downwelling, they correlate very well in the compression region. So they are swept in the compression region in this filamentary structure. And if you plot the correlation between the divergence and the probability distribution of particle position, we see that the maximum of particle position is definitely at the divergence value below zero, negative divergence value. If we induce stratification, we see that this correlation is broken. And basically, we have a more uniform distribution, so particles can go where they want. So there is not more correlation between divergence and particle position. But you see, the most probable, yes, it's a bit negative, but not much negative. So this means that if we compute particle distribution, it's more homogeneous in the stratified case than in the non-stratified case, which is good for us. Because, I mean, when we have lots of algae, perhaps there is stratification, and these are rather uniformly distributed.
In all cases, the particle Stokes number was very small.
It's very small. You can consider in these cases that particles are Bayesian tracers. It's a good representation. Now, in the following, we computed another way. We used another way to compute particle segregation, which is called Voronoi analysis. Basically, it's just the correlation dimension, but it doesn't go with the distance between two particles. It just associates some area with each particle. So the larger is the area occupied by one particle, the better. The larger is the Voronoi, the better is the particle. So it's a density measured by the area instead of the distance. If we compute, so basically what we did, we compute around each particle. There is an algorithm which is very easy. It's in MATLAB anyways. And basically you consider these two particles and you consider the distance between these two particles. You divide it in two. And the same for these two particles, you divide it in two. And for each particle, you have some neighbors. You divide in two the distance between two neighbors. And then you have the area of the cell occupied by each particle. If we compute the distribution of this, the PDF of these areas, you see that in the case of zero stratification, all particles occupy, I mean, the most probable area is very small. So all particles are, like in Singapore or in Hong Kong, very densely populated. And in the stratified flows, it's like in California, or I don't know, Ohio, perhaps, or other places. There is a much more, much less density, much less densely populated regions. So I think that.
Is there a peak on your intermediate Richardson number? There seems to be a recurring scale that gets worked out.
Yes, there might be. We don't know. These results are rather new. We didn't have the time to investigate if it's a real peak. Just had one statistic, so we're not really sure. There might be one peak, but we don't know. With this, I thank you and I finish. My voice helped me until now.
So is there a conclusion that's illuminating for these plankton experiments or observations?
Regarding the plankton, regarding the granular flow?
Regarding the drift velocities of the plankton.
Well, there's no conclusion yet. We are investigating this. We computed the drift velocity of the slightly buoyant particles in the DNS. I didn't show that, because I was not satisfied to find that the drift velocity of our slightly buoyant particles was smaller than the Stokes velocity, not larger than the Stokes velocity. So this is why I didn't show. But we were not happy with that. So, I mean, our hypothesized mechanism, which we hypothesized a few years ago, it's not working if we do direct numerical simulation. We don't know why. So there must be another explanation.
I had a problem seeing the graph that you showed that you did the comparison between the velocities for different Stokes number than when you filtered the LES, the one that you did for different Stokes number.
So this is just the streamwise velocity. So perhaps I was too quick on that. So what we did was we computed the fluid velocity at particle position in the DNS in the streamwise direction. Then we filtered the flow field.
Right.
Particle was not changing the position. And we computed the velocity, which was now associated to the larger cell in the filtered case. And we found that if there is not much of a difference in the center of the channel, and in addition, there is a positive difference, so the larger the simulation overpredicts the streamwise velocity in the sense, slightly overpredicts. It goes negative going to the wall. So what happens is that filtering, we must somehow cancel, it is actually what is done, some correlation between the streamwise velocity and the wall normal velocity. So in the larger dissimulation, it's like we weakened the Reynolds stress correlation. And this is why there is a deficit of wall parallel velocity in the filtered simulations. Now, if we have a curve like this of the deficiency of the difference of the velocity on larger simulation, you want to put this model, but it's not, you know, it's not easy to write a model this way. I mean, you should somehow explain why, which we are still in the process to explain. Now, perhaps I didn't clarify what we did exactly. We did a DNS with particles. And keeping the particle with the correct DNS trajectory, we went to compute what was the velocity in the larger dissimulation. So the particles were now at the exact position they should occupy, say, in physics, in the true physics, and the velocity deficit was now computed. So this is what we did.
I'm just having a hard time to see which one's Stokes number one. Is it the one with the most error in the
I'm having the same hard time. Let's see if I can see from here. Now, this is Stokes 5, this is Stokes 25,
no.
This is Stokes 5, 25, and 1. So there is also an inversion in these two.
Because I think you early on mentioned something which is, I don't quite get this, because I think you said if the Stokes number is very small, then doing an LES would probably introduce more error for smaller particles. So that's why I was a little bit confused here.
But in fact, I said that if the Stokes number is very large, you would introduce less error.
Right.
Because basically what happens is like when you move among vortices, if you're very inertial, you cross through vortices. If you're not very inertial, you're bound to follow the vortices. So if I cancel out the small vortices, you will go straight. But your real trajectory would be this. So if you have large particles, the error should be small. Now this plot has a crossover at the point which we didn't expect. So, I mean, we just computed this data, and we are not really, we don't know exactly what to do yet with this data, because we were computing this data with the hope of deriving a model for, so we wanted to introduce in the large jelly simulation a stochastic forcing for particles. Like Herman was discussing yesterday, but the stochastic forcing should have the correct PDF of the velocity and of the velocity fluctuations to be reintroduced in the LES. And we were hoping with this mistake to reintroduce those. We are just, I mean, we're just in the middle of a step, or perhaps in the beginning of the step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you decide.
well, maybe I'll go first then. One of the more striking features of your results was this accumulation of particles with large Stokes number next to the wall. Now that does seem surprising, because particles with large Stokes number can move for a large distance without feeling the effect of the turbulence. I'm wondering, how did you treat the collisions with the wall? Was it just a specular reflection?
Exactly, fully elastic.
Yeah.
Fully elastic. So that is the the worst case scenario. So you mean this? No, not this. Oops, I'm not sure. Anyways, it's this. And these are large particles, but these are not very large. These will be dominated by the rebound. These will not be dominated by the rebound. We computed, we wrote another paper with the people in Cornell. They made an experiment, and we computed, we made the direct numerical simulation to match their experiments, and we computed the acceleration of particles which reach the wall. Actually, I consider these particles large, but the acceleration they undergo while they go to the wall is so strong, and when they hit the wall, they hit it very mildly. So the rebound is not very important. Even if I speak about this like large particles, they are not able to carry along enough momentum to bounce back high enough to be re-entrained. This is what these do, not what these do. In the people in the deposition or sedimentation community, they treat particles according to the Stokes number in three different regimes. In diffusion regimes, of which they deposit only because of Brownian diffusion. The inertial regime, which the regime is you're referring to, and its Stokes number, actually normalized Stokes number, well over 100. And the immediate regime, there is a combination of these two. So turbulence induced diffusion and some inertia, which is exactly why it is difficult to predict the position rates of these particles, because you have these two mechanisms which drive particles to the position. So rebounds are not very strong, important.
I was wondering, more general question, when you think about it, I mean, basically you show that it's very difficult to correct for the coarsening out that you do with LES compared to DNS. When one thinks about what happens going from DNS to LES, this is a little bit like the things that occur in quantum field theory when you do renormalization, when you will change the scale at which you compute. And as far as I know, ideas from the renormalization group have been applied to turbulence, so that we'll see how to correct for changes in scale. And do your results imply that there is basically no way to correct for that by renormalization group methods or so?
Not sure, but there is a big difference between and LES and particles, because what happens is that when you have a fluid and you want to model the fluid behavior at the subgrid scale, then you have a coherent motion of the fluid. So all the fluid is behaving nicely altogether. If you have particles, like what Bala was saying, yes, you may have one particle here, and they are characterized by different velocity. So what happens is that to correct the motion of the particle inside the grid, you should know the history of the particle previously, because the particle can be here and here, not because they are coherently moving with the fluid, but just because they've been there just by chance. So, and this chance is something we would like to quantify, and it depends on the history of the particles. This is why it is hard to predict these things. And this happens only when particles are inertial enough to be there by different reasons, different circumstances. So this mechanism is known by clustering, segregation, and also there are people who call it, my Greeks call it RAM, random uncorrelated motions. Other people call it in different ways. But the problem is that if you have a fine, for instance, another problem, you have a I mean, I just played in the sandbox for kids, so very simple experiment. Particles all the same. But if you have different size of particles, you may have particles which are nicely behaving altogether, like what Bala was showing yesterday. And then there is a strong particle which comes here by a totally different position. How would you model that? So you have, it's not, renormalization group is not enough for particles, I think. It was enough for the fluid. LES for the fluid is fine. It can predict the shear, the wall shear, very nicely for high Reynolds number flows. Many people are doing very nice things with LES, but not for multiphase flow. There is still work to be done. Good for us.
Could you, for instance, do something like change the particle properties according to the scale that you are computing at, that you are computing your flow at?
Mean to derive a model.
An effective settling velocity that would depend on which scale you resolve in the calculation?
Well, you mean that we produce a subscale model for particles, which is a function of particle Stokes number and other things, something like that?
Something like that, perhaps?
Well, so it's going to be, the best idea is to find a local model, so something which is a Eulerian model which can work locally. But the problem is that we've not yet succeeded in doing that. So a simple solution would be to put the boundary condition a little higher than the wall. All particles are small, as I said initially, in the center of the channel. The boundary condition is not at the wall. We have the boundary condition here, and then all particles which have to go there. But this is a very crude model. This is a model people do for practical applications. But to do a nice model, for instance, you have complicated fluids in which you want to make particles react or collide, it's not easy.
But suppose you have, the motion of the particles resembles something like a random walk.
Right.
And if you were to superpose a random walk on the more or less coherent motion of the particles,
that was
you could adjust perhaps the parameters of the random walk.
Well, it doesn't work. People did that. People, I think there is Apte who's doing that. Apte.
There are a lot of people doing the Ornstein process with the right parameters in there, like the way you say. So there's a correlated motion coming from the fluid and the underworld motion. You do that. Random walk like process, Ornstein process, with a little bit of memory, the time scale of it comes from time scale of underworld turbulence. Intensity comes from the kinetic energy of the subgrid scale. Now you can do that as a function of vertical distance, etc. So people like Henrati, Soffer, Reynolds, yesterday, somebody present at Reynolds score. So there are models out there.
We use Langevin equations for this. This is what people are trying to do now. So perhaps there is a solution. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no solution. It's just that it's a little work.
So in some sense, particles motion the unresolved fluid motion on particle can be handled this way. But there's also another question: is the classic Fourier's closure model for the fluid equations have to now take into account the presence of the particles. And that, again, is
kind of
one.
Okay. I can think we can stop here. And thank
you.
And see you at the barbecue this afternoon, 4:30.